Hello again from the Baltimore Sun. I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 292 for Thursday, the 24th day of August already, the 24th of August, 2017. Talking politics on the show today with Peter Jensen, a member of the Baltimore Sun's editorial board, and Richard J. Cross III, former Capitol Hill and Annapolis press secretary and speechwriter. And the reason I have him on the show, he's a mild-mannered, moderate Maryland Republican, and we love him. Richard will be joining us a little bit later in the show. We start with Peter. Nice to see you, Peter.
Dan, always a pleasure.
So we're recording this on Wednesday. People will hear it on Thursday. And we're coming out of the president's rally in Arizona. Something weird happened to me. I was watching it on the couch. I was watching a particular video of him when he was talking about Joe Arpaio, right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether he should pardon him or not. He asked the crowd the question. The crowd roared, right? And then he looks around with his chin up in the air, curling his lip, nodding his head, acknowledging the crowd. And I'm seeing a newsreel of Benito Mussolini. I'm sorry, but I this is where my mind goes to. Maybe it's because I'm half Italian. I don't know. So I went to YouTube, and there's plenty of 1930s speeches of Mussolini, and I watched, and it was uncanny to me. Some of the facial expressions, the movements, the cocksuredness of this and nodding of this and the curling of a lip, very strange. So I was channeling Benito Mussolini, and I know Trump fans who tune into the podcast. I know they do because I get mail from them. They'll just love my reference to an Italian dictator. Anyway, it's very weird to see a president of the United States conducting these rallies, a sitting president who's, you know, doesn't have to run for re-election for another 2 years, at least 2.5 years. So that's weird. And then there's the content of what he had to say. So,
well, first, let me say on the Mussolini thing, can I say that I like to resist that comparison whenever possible, because I understand what you're coming from.
Yeah.
But this is exactly the sort of bait that the Trump supporters love to hear people in the media use comparisons to
dictators,
yeah, to say, oh, you've got the what do they call it, the Trump derangement syndrome or whatever.
Right.
Even no matter how apt they become over time, and I must say, as time moves on, they do seem to become more apt and not less.
Well, I'm a columnist,
right,
and you're a thoughtful editorial writer.
Right.
I'm not as thoughtful as you are, so I just I give my visceral reaction to things sometimes.
Well, I understand that,
and maybe it was the Campari and soda I had before watching. Maybe that influenced my channeling of Mussolini while I was watching Trump. But it is weird, Peter, to see these rallies. I mean, presidents give speeches. Obama did it. All of the predecessors did. But these rallies are weird and reminiscent of the dictator on the balcony, you know, enjoying the adulation of a giant crowd.
Let me say one or two differences. One is I thought the crowd showed less enthusiasm for this particular rally than I've seen in quite some time. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but as it went on, you could see the empty seats, and particularly when, and we'll talk about this, the about 15-minute long spiel he gave, once again going through his reaction, his initial reaction to
Charlottesville.
I mean, even if you're the most ardent Trump acolyte, did you sit there and think, oh, let's discuss that again for 15 minutes and do it in an extremely misleading fashion, which I'm sure we'll also get into. But I don't know. It's just
I think you're right about the crowd reaction. I just think it's weird to have these rallies in the presidency.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think you have a correct impression of that.
Well, and the other subtext I look at is I wonder, what is John Kelly thinking about right now? Because you know he's thinking, let's not go there. He's thinking, this is a fraught area.
Yeah.
We're trying to unite the country. This is our theme. And he's going back to, you know, racial prejudice and divisive issues, and has to relive a moment that even so many members of his own party were extremely unhappy with. What's the sense of that? Why?
I don't understand.
What's the strategy
it either
in that?
I don't understand it.
I don't know.
How do you explain it?
Right.
Politically, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. Exactly.
This is all ego. This is They said I didn't say enough, that I didn't condemn the white supremacists enough. But listen, listen, this is what I said.
Right. And clearly his staff told him that because, you know, remember on Monday he came in and had a much more forceful condemnation of white supremacists than he had mustered on Saturday. So, and that sort of made sense. And that was putting him on the correct path. And then,
it all went away on the Tuesday press conference at Trump Tower. Yeah. Also, key to this, as the president was going through what he said initially during the violence in Charlottesville, he left out the key words, many sides, that there was violence, we condemn violence on many sides, on many sides. He left that out as he was going over this again for the crowd in Arizona.
Exactly. And
those are the key words.
Right. And he said that. This was like, am I really seeing this? He said that after he did this extremely forceful condemnation of the media, singling out the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN for not presenting his views, which, by the way, they actually did present in a full way. I mean, CNN ran it live that Saturday, for not giving him a full and a clear, you know, opportunity to express his views, which they gave. And then he described his own actions, leaving out the offending words. So he was guilty of the very thing he accused the media sitting there of doing. That's what made it this sort of psychological moment, like that this was we're watching a clinical explanation of projection.
Yeah. We may not go to the dictator thing. Maybe that makes you uncomfortable, my reference to Mussolini. I'm looking at this aesthetically, I guess. And, you know, he's not a dictator. He's an elected president of the United States, and he could be impeached, and he could lose the next election. But still, there's something going on here where you have the president of the United States behaving like this big egomaniac that's out of control, an impulsive man who's always on the attack, always certainly attacking the media all the time, and then attacking other politicians who he should be allied with to get things done in Washington. Mitch McConnell, just one example of it, the Senate leader, you know, always on the attack, always on the defensive, always on the defensive with an offensive tweet of some kind.
Right. And let me say that need to attack worked for him in the campaign.
Right.
I'm not seeing it as effective now. What should be scaring him right now is not how CNN is describing his behavior. It's how the majority leader of the Senate is describing his behavior, which, according to the New York Times, he's saying, well, it looks like, you know, it's pretty much over.
Yeah, we're not going to be able to get anything done.
Yeah, yeah.
He may not survive this presidency.
Right.
This is what Mitch McConnell apparently is saying privately.
Right.
And they've had a very stormy relationship, I guess, since the so-called reform of the Affordable Care Act went down, Trump blaming McConnell for that, saying he should step down as leader. And then McConnell apparently on the phone with the president, according to the New York Times, getting into a profane argument.
Right.
It's not hard to imagine. The president focused on the media again in this speech in Arizona, saying, well, the Times headline today is, at rally, Trump blames media for country's deepening divisions. Would that have been your headline on – that could have been a headline off of
Absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. Right? I thought there were at least two things going on there. One is he spent a lot of time lambasting the media. And as someone described it, he said he had more fury directed at the media than he did at any neo-Nazi that one could speak of. But the other thing, and this was a sort of the lost opportunity, is that don't you think that you know, he was warned not even to show up in Phoenix by the mayor. The governor didn't attend. He was not happy with this. They sense, and many others sense, this is not a time for partisan division. This is post-Charlottesville. We're still in a sort of period of a little bit of recovery here and a concern about where race relations are,
right,
where sort of we are as a country, sort of our shared idea of the country. And reaching out and seeking consensus of being inclusive, that was what people expect. And so it's not just what he said, it's what he did not say. It's what he failed to take this opportunity. Instead, makes his little endorsement of Joe Arpaio.
Yeah, who was held in contempt of court for continuing to engage in racial profiling.
That's right.
In law enforcement.
When the Justice Department specifically told him he could not, and they had evidence to show not only had he instructed his staff, he had made public comment about he was not going to follow the Justice Department's decision and previous judicial decision on this, to then sort of, I mean, he didn't pardon Arpaio.
No, but he made it, talked about it.
He made it pretty clear that's his intent and that's what's going to happen down the road. At a moment like this, and sort of expand the feeling of his failure to truly condemn the white supremacists, and then sort of expand it to say, oh, we can also talk about the border and Mexicans and all the things that Arpaio is sort of known for. That's really troubling.
Yeah. Well, is he tone deaf? Does he have a tin ear? Does he just not care? Has he taken too much advice from Steve Bannon, even though Bannon's not there anymore, to just sort of plow ahead, say whatever he feels like saying, because that's what got him there?
Well, I think it's that, and I think it's also a healthy ego and a need to have that ego stroked. The need to be in front of a crowd and say things that you know don't play well with the people with whom you are fighting, and to show, oh, look, they're cheering me as I say these things. To have that positive reinforcement, he craves that.
Yeah, I know.
And I think that is a large part of it, as much as I don't even think it's tactical at all times. I think it's a desire to just serve his purposes.
I totally agree with you, because I keep looking at this, and people ask me, why does he keep behaving this way? Why does he keep talking this way? I say, well, wait a minute. You're expecting a pivot of some kind? Are you still looking for the presidential pivot when Donald J. Trump starts acting presidential? I don't think he's capable of it. But does he think with 36% or 38% approval he can win re-election, or that he can help Republicans in the midterms?
Or even more alarmingly, his disapproval rate in the swing states, the Michigans, the Ohios, the Pennsylvanias, is in the 55% range. So the states that he needed to win last time are leaving him right now. I mean, he still has, if you poll Republicans, he still has pretty strong support, which is, sadly enough, I think speaks to the division in our country right now than it does about his personal appeal. But there's no tactical help coming from an event like this. I don't think. I mean, they talk about rallying your base. I don't think it even rallies his base.
Yeah. Very much. And this other thing about the president of the United States being a moral leader in times of crisis, in times of national mourning, in times of heightened tension about something going on in our society, the president speaks and calms us down, tries to speak to our better nature. I never expected that from Trump. I don't think he's capable of it. And, you know, if you just looked at his record as a campaigner, how he campaigned, what he said, all the attacks that he made against the opposition, continuing to call people crooked or whatnot in his presidency with tweets, how is this type of person? Are we going to really, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? I mean, are we going to turn our lonely eyes to Donald Trump and look for consolation?
No, I doubt many people do that. I think people...
Well, then he's not... I don't think he's capable of it. You see what I mean?
No, I would agree from a... If he was asked to ad-lib something, I agree. But at some point, surely, even anyone who can walk and talk and read can sit in front of a teleprompter, which is what most presidents do, let's face it, and read a prepared speech.
But you got to sell it, Peter.
Yeah, okay.
You and I can read a teleprompter, but you got to sell it.
Maybe so.
I don't think he's capable of that sale.
Right.
Of all the sales he's pulled off, all the deals, well, I don't think he can pull that one off.
His Monday Charlottesville speech was a teleprompter sales job.
Right.
It was not that bad. I didn't think it was that bad. It was not as heartfelt as he sometimes seems when he's speaking more off the cuff. But
I can't be the only person who's developed a sort of jaundiced view of this. I don't expect to hear that from Donald Trump.
No, and I think his supporters don't look to inform that
Mike
for that
Pence
either.
Probably, I would. He might be able to sell it better. What?
Well, no, I just find Mike Pence's recent comments about pretty much everything just laughable.
His defense of Trump.
There's like a Stepford Wife quality to him that is stunning. that they used to talk about George H.W. Bush putting his manhood in a blind trust. Something in the brain function has gone in the blind trust for Mike Pence. It's just like you can just see when he says stuff like about how Trump has done this or that, and you know, no rational person really believes that. But he tries to sell it. He gives it his 100%. So
the president gave a speech Monday night this week about Afghanistan. And I don't know what to make of it. It seemed a little vague to me. We're going back. We're upping the ante militarily in Afghanistan again. We're going to kill terrorists. We're not going to nation build. That's what I pulled away from it.
Yes. Well, and that's a fairly accurate representation of what was said. It was...
and we're not going to tell you how many more troops we're going to bring in.
Although people on the staff are willing to tell you it's in the neighborhood of 4,000. And although there's no talk about what the timetable is. What's fascinating about this is not that it's such a reversal of where he's been on the subject, which it is. But frankly, every president has been pretty much all over the map on this.
Mm-hmm.
It's that this president who has seemed to be so much about rejecting his predecessor in every policy area is essentially going to the same place. He talks about a surge. Barack Obama did the surge. He talks about expecting more from Pakistan. Barack Obama talked about doing more from Pakistan. He talked about using the economic pull of the United States. Barack Obama talked about using... I mean, there's very little... And plus, there was an overarching desire to get U.S. involvement. And he rejected nation building.
Right.
All these things have been said before. I mean, it's been 16-year history with Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
There's hardly a place you can go policy-wise that hasn't been said before. It's just not... You know, it looks like we're headed toward permanent U.S. involvement in that region. And maybe
to try to keep the Taliban in check.
Right. And maybe you can make the justification. Maybe you can say, it's like Korea. This is just what we have to do. But no one wants to do that, right? He talked about how it's winnable, how we can kill the terrorists. Does anyone believe that? I mean, do you believe that?
No. I thought it was interesting, the timing of Bannon's departure and this speech on Monday. You know, they said the generals took over. The generals pretty much wrote this speech. But the anti-globalist Bannon is out of the picture. And so the president announced something on Monday that I'm sure Bannon would have opposed.
No, absolutely. Although I'm not sure how much clout he had in the final weeks.
Toward the end there. It'll be interesting to see how much power Bannon wields now outside of the White House back at Breitbart.
I'll wait to see how this ever polls. But I don't think when a Republican president stands up and says, we're going to kill terrorists, he loses a lot of support from his party. Maybe there is a certain wing, that sort of Rand Paul wing that's not excited, libertarian crowd.
Right.
That's a pretty small portion. And as much as Bannon seemed to have, you know, at one point this huge Svengali effect, I don't think that's really going to translate into a huge problem for him.
Okay, Peter. Well, thank you very much, and I'll lay off the Mussolini references. Is that your advice?
Well,
I was watching CNN today, and some guy defending Trump. They got rid of Jeffrey Lord, you know, so they brought in some other guy now to defend Trump, who says that, you know, crazy liberals are calling the president crazy, saying that he's mentally disturbed and all that stuff. And he said, look, if you don't like the president, that's fine, but don't be doing any psychoanalysis from a distance. I didn't do that. All I did was make an aesthetic reference to Mussolini's chin.
It's the chin. All right.
Okay. Peter Jensen is a member of the Baltimore Sun's editorial board who joins us from time to time on Roughly Speaking to discuss politics and current events.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent, locally owned bookseller. The shop offers the best in literature, current affairs, history, poetry, and, of course, books about Baltimore. The Ivy is located at Falls Road at Lake Avenue in Mount Washington. Check us out at theivybookshop.com. The right book is waiting.
Hi, I'm Quinn Kelly, and I host a weekly podcast for the Baltimore Sun called Female Trouble. Each Tuesday, we feature a new long-form conversation with one of the area's most interesting and accomplished women, from public officials and congresswomen to rappers and restaurant owners. You can find Female Trouble on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Find more info at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble.
And on the most recent episode of Female Trouble, Quinn Kelly speaks with Crystal Mack, a pastry chef and business owner. Crystal is the owner of Black Sugar Bakery, which at the time of the recording was located in Our House, the food hall in Remington. Crystal Mack has since left Our House and talks to Quinn about her next move. That's on the current Female Trouble. Now to political commentator Richard J. Cross III, mild-mannered moderate Maryland Republican, and I take it a pretty disgusted citizen. Hello, Richard.
Good to be here.
I take it pretty disgusted because I got an email from you after Charlottesville, your comments about Trump. Pretty troubling the way he handled it on Saturday. He seemed to make a comeback on Monday and then the Tuesday press conference. That's when you wrote to me.
When I read the transcript for it, I have a friend who lives in Charlottesville and she was fighting this whole kind of planned rally for a week leading up to when it happened. And I said, yeah, that's right. The Nazis are coming. You know, aren't you being a little bit melodramatic? And then I turned on CNN that weekend.
Unite the right.
It was absolutely horrifying.
The torchbearers, starting with that, that tableau on Friday night, alone should have called for the president to say something. And then he waited until Saturday when there was actually violence.
Yeah.
And a young woman was killed. And then he made the both sides comment. And then we get to Monday and his staff evidently said to him, you know, you've got to come back from this and make it clear and unequivocal how we feel about white supremacists, KKK, and neo-Nazis. And he did that. It's just that he hardly ever sounds like that. You know, he's always bombastic or sarcastic or snarky.
Yeah.
To hear him speaking with reverence is difficult, right?
Right.
In a sober way and reverent. And then Tuesday, we saw the real Trump.
Now, in terms of how Trump should have responded, yeah, I think the Monday comment wasn't one for the presidential kind of archive of greatness, but it was competent. Tuesday, whatever goodwill he built, he'd kind of unwound. But also, I questioned why he was holding the event at Trump Tower. I think any other president, you know, John Kennedy or Ronald Reagan, would have jumped on the Marine One, gone and stood in Thomas Jefferson's porch nearby, where there's a cemetery where there are Black Americans or white Americans who are descended from him. And spoke there. The symbolism, I think, would have carried the day.
See, Richard, you worked as a speechwriter and press secretary for an elected official, a Republican elected official, and you're thinking the old way, the conventional way. So we're told not to expect this from Trump, you know, that he's very different, that he can just bust through all the old ideas and conventions and say what he wants, and people will love him. Well, the polls are showing that people don't love it.
I mean, his little sliver of the Republican base, you know, he's still got them on board, but I think eventually even they're going to lose patience with him.
Do you think he understands that?
I'm not sure that he cares. I think that he thinks he won the presidency. He's got a gigantic ego, and he thinks the country will eventually, you know, they'll move towards him. He doesn't have to move towards them.
You think that's what's going on? Could you imagine working for him?
Well, I mean, based on the experience with how quickly some of his senior staff have come and gone, it really does have the feel of survivor to it.
What would you do, though? Say you were working in the press office at the White House or in an advisory capacity you were brought in. I'm not sure you would want to work for Donald Trump, but say you did. You'd have to be ready for the unexpected all the time. Temperamental president, you know, having to satisfy his ego rather than to do the serious work of governing.
I mean, I would try to sell my value as a speechwriter. That's kind of what I would bring to the table. At this point, I think he's not comfortable following a script, obviously. He likes winging it. He likes deviating from the script because it builds his brand. I'm not sure what his brand is getting him at this point. The country's very divided. It's polarizing. And presidents, when they come in, they're supposed to build a team that's going to last at least through the first term. Obama picked up Rahm Emanuel, who lasted almost through the first term until he ran for mayor. George W. Bush picked Andy Card, who lasted the first term. And it's just this turnover. There's no opportunity to move forward.
And also conventional thinking has always been, actually history backs this up, that the first year of a presidency is probably when you get the most done.
Oh, absolutely.
Most accomplished.
The first 100 days, yeah.
So looking back on this, what's Trump got to show for it?
Gorsuch.
But that's Gorsuch appointment to the Supreme Court.
That's probably as much McConnell as it is Trump.
Yeah, we're going to talk about McConnell with Richard Cross in this segment of the show in just a minute. Do people recognize that he's not accomplishing anything?
I think people in his base basically are happy with him. I think, and last time I was here, we talked about the marriage between the establishment Republicans and the Trump folks being kind of an unholy marriage. Now I think we're moving towards an unholy divorce because the Senate seems to be in rebellion against him.
Yeah. Let's talk about this. The Senate more than the House.
Right.
So far. Mitch McConnell, according to the New York Times this week, is at war with the president, it sounds like. course, the president picked that fight after the failure of this so-called reform of the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
That was such a mess. But anyway, it didn't happen. And then almost the next day, Trump is blaming McConnell, saying McConnell should resign as Senate Majority Leader, saying negative things about a guy who needs to be your ally going forward. There's that. And then there's we hear comments from people like Lindsey Graham, Bob Corker, the two women who voted against this reform of the Affordable Care Act, Murkowski and Collins,
yep.
Right? They both talked about how they were being intimidated or strong-armed by the White House. That didn't go over too well. I don't know how the White House, how is Trump in any position to strong-arm anybody in the Senate?
Well, you think about presidents who've worked to get their agendas through in the past of both parties. You know, Reagan with his tax bill and spending reductions, and Obama with Obamacare. I don't see where the Trump White House actively weighed in during the Obamacare debate, other than it's just kind of lecture senators from the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, you see what I'm getting at is, what do they have? Jeff Flake is running for re-election in Arizona, mm-hmm. right? Trump can say negative things about Jeff Flake, but what does that add up to? Does that really hurt him?
Well, it will if it costs Republicans control of the Senate, which it could, because if the Trump people try to basically, you know, front their own candidates in these races against senators they don't like, one has to wonder, given the dynamics of a midterm election.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
What does Trump really have to offer somebody who wants to, run against someone like Jeff Flake, a sitting senator?
No, it's just basically fear of Twitter.
Fear of Twitter.
Yeah.
But does that work?
I don't think it's worked so far.
I don't see what kind of power he wields.
Well, this is, I think, another example of how he suffered because he never held elective office before this one, because you've got people who basically served as governor, who know how to work with the legislature, build deals and relationships, and it's not a partisan phenomenon, it's an experiential phenomenon, whereas Trump, when you're basically CEO of your own company, you know, basically it's my way or the highway, and I think that's his governance mentality.
The stuff after Charlottesville that's stuck to Trump. I mean, it's sticking. I think maybe not so much his comments about Confederate monuments, because polls indicate that people think Confederate monuments should stay in place. But, you know, he goes overboard and refers to them as our beautiful monuments and confuses Robert E. Lee with George Washington. But leave that aside for a moment. These comments in Charlottesville, about Charlottesville, that he can try to revise— but it doesn't work. We heard what he had to say. He equated neo-Nazis and white supremacists with the people who oppose them. Okay,
yep.
That doesn't work, right? And it leaves people like McConnell, according to this New York Times story, profoundly disturbed about who the president is and whether he can actually last, whether he's fit to be president. You're starting to hear these things from Republicans. So what do they get by associating with Trump?
Well, it's funny you bring that up. I was talking to a friend of mine last night who pointed out to me that McConnell's approval rating in Kentucky is 18%.
I saw that he is so low now, too.
And yeah. But Trump is still relatively robust in his approvals.
Yeah. So, what does that tell you?
Well, that Trump's people have stuck with him for the time being. The establishment Republicans are suffering because of the relationship with Trump.
Did you just say chump?
That was an accident.
Let's talk about what's ahead a little bit. I mean, the Senate can't fool around here, because when it comes back into session, it faces the debt ceiling. You know, until a few years ago, most Americans didn't even know what this was, right?
This was
sort of pro forma, something the Congress just acted on. They have to raise the statutory limit on government borrowing. And these Tea Party guys got down there in Washington and said, well, wait a minute, why are we doing this? Well, they said, well, we have to do it. We have to pay our bills. The government has to pay the bills.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to negotiate it, remember?
Yeah, I remember that.
And it actually caused the government shutdown.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's coming up. And then there's tax reform, infrastructure spending, the whole budget process.
Right.
So, geez, can you imagine what's ahead?
Well, tax reform is the third rail issue for Republicans. So unless they make progress on that issue, then I think going into the midterms— They're fundamentally damaged, because, you know, obviously they suffered by not having any progress on repealing or replacing Obamacare, which was another third rail issue. Tax reform is its own kind of battle, and infrastructure is important as well, because it's very important to the business community. So you've got these major issues coming down the pike. whether or not the president will work with Congress in getting them done, or show kind of traditional executive leadership from the White House in getting them done. That's a huge unanswered question.
Do they need him? I mean, can't they work this out? For instance, the debt limit. Do they need the president involved in that?
Well, traditionally, I think having the president working, with your caucus helps. In this particular case, I'm not so sure anymore.
No, I think there's distancing from Trump, it mm-hmm. seems to me. I mean, there are a few defenders who speak up. Shepard Smith on Fox News said he couldn't find any Republican to come on and defend Trump after the Charlottesville comments.
Right.
I think we're going to be seeing more and more of that. He's alienated so many senators. The word fury is actually used in the New York Times story here. I just wanted to read this to you. The fury among Senate Republicans toward Trump has been building since last month, even before he lashed out at Mr. McConnell. Some of them blame the president for not being able to rally the party around any version of legislation to repeal the Affordable Care Act, accusing him of not knowing even the basics about the policy. Senate Republicans also say strong-arm tactics from the White House backfired, making it harder to cobble together votes and have left bad feelings in the caucus. One thing about the Affordable Care Act, Republicans for 7 years said, we're going to repeal it, we're going to repeal it, we're going to repeal it and replace it.
And how many votes did the House have? Like 60-some votes about, repealing it strategic votes or procedural votes. Yeah, you're right.
Well, what they didn't count on, Richard, was Obamacare becoming more popular. I thought the most honest comment I heard was from a man quoted in a Washington Post story who said, well, I didn't like Obamacare. I didn't vote for Obama. I don't like Obamacare. But now that it's there, you can't take it away from people. This is some guy in the Midwest who I think had voted for Trump. And that's a pretty honest, common sense comment that probably is the prevailing feeling among people who say they've changed their mind about this. So Republicans didn't anticipate that people were going to change their minds, right? So are they really going to be hurt when they go back home and run for re-election because they didn't repeal Obamacare?
Well, I think they need to achieve progress in other areas in order to kind of hit the reset button. So if tax reform works out and infrastructure works out and they're able to kind of come up with some sort of compromise in immigration, for example, that could help them. But at this point, there's the agenda is kind of barren.
That's an interesting word you just used, compromise. there's actually been talk, some rumblings about Democrats and Republicans working together again.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So is it possible Donald Trump ends up moving government along because of that? Because Democrats and Republicans realize this guy's bad news. We got to work something out here.
Well, I think it was Senator Lamar Alexander and Senator Patty Murray, who the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Help Committee, had made comments along those lines. But keep in mind that senators and politicians are self-protective creatures. And if I were in their position right now, looking ahead to November 2018, I'd be pretty darn worried.
So what would you be telling the public?
I would set expectations, kind of build a common sense record of progress. I'm not sure what progress they're going to make in the Affordable Care Act at this point, but I think there are opportunities in taxes and infrastructure especially.
Do you see the Republican Party continuing to prevail in state, local elections around the country, even with Trump?
It's a good question. I think that Republicans at the gubernatorial level are probably better insulated than members of Congress. But it depends on how big the anti-Trump tsunami that's coming is going to be.
And it also depends on whether you're a governor who supported Trump or kept your distance from him, right?
Right. And when governor,
like here in Maryland.
Right. Governor Hogan, basically, I think he made a correct call during the campaign. Now it's more of a complex governance strategy. But so far, I think he's basically... He and the governor of Massachusetts have both followed the basic same strategy, is focus on your state and assert yourself and your differences with the White House when you have to.
Right. And on the Democratic side, there was this new theme sounded by Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi a few weeks ago. I've forgotten what it is. A new deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they used a new deal or a better deal, right? It might not hurt them to bring up the New Deal at this point to satisfy the progressives or people who want to see the Democrats identify with the working class again. Donald Trump pulled a lot of the working class away. So do you see the Democrats really benefiting? I mean, it's kind of hard to predict what happens in 2018. The tendency is to think that Trump has done a lot of damage to the Republicans already, but I'm not sure.
Well, I think the Democrats nationally in both there and in Maryland have followed the same basic strategy of attack Trump, you know, point out the flaws of Trump, but and that obviously that's his politics that has a role to play. But what they haven't done is articulated their own agenda, which would kind of, along what you just said, appeal to working class people who have economic angst, who voted for Trump because they're worried about their jobs and their futures and the cost of health care and national security. You know, they haven't kind of come up with an alternate strategy.
You know, they don't even remind people about where all the things that benefit working class people come from in the main, from the Democratic Party.
Right.
Minimum wage, child labor laws, all those, you know, they sound like cliches, but they didn't. They don't articulate those things.
I think Bernie Sanders tried.
Yeah, Bernie did. Yeah. All right, Richard. Well, thank you very much.
Sure.
I guess you're still disturbed about who the president is.
I didn't vote for him, so.
Yeah, I know. Well, thank you very much.
Good to be here.
Richard J. Cross III is a former Capitol Hill and Annapolis press secretary and speechwriter who provides perspective on political news as a Maryland Republican. He joins us from time to time on the podcast, along with our array of commentators who make regular visits to the show. And that's our program for now. We welcome comments about it on Facebook or Twitter or by email. Just write to me, droddricks@baltsun.com. On Friday, we get Paula Gallagher's weekly book recommendation. Then, Baltimore's best storyteller, Gilbert Sandler, talks about growing up in Baltimore and the many changes that have taken place over the 9 decades he's been observing and chronicling city life. I hope you'll join us for that show. For producer Steve Early, I'm Dan Roderick. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking from the Baltimore Sun, and we'll see you again soon.